product not yet rated. Welcome to the Lost Pages of Norse Myth. I'm Jason Weiser, your narrator and host of the Myths and Legends podcast. Each month, join us here as we reveal a missing page from the Prose Edda, the great book that contains all of Norse myth. It's whispered that these lost pages tell the story of a god from a distant land and his young son as they embark on a perilous journey across the Norse realms. I present now the third lost page, and only rage remained. The unanswered cries of his terrified child echoed across the winter woods. Tears, falling from the face of this realm's newest widow, poked almost unnoticeable holes in the blood-spattered snow. The man's body lay in a heap at the foot of a great, fallen tree, his head staring back at him from where it landed a dozen yards over, mouth still agape in panic and horror at the bloody consequences for simply crossing the creature's path. And the creature responsible for this nightmarish scene lumbered on, its terrible mind not caring for what it had just wrought in the slightest, not satisfied in the least with its freshest kill, turning, instead, to seek yet another target for its unquenchable rage. There was a name for such creatures in the Nine Realms. Draugr, a twisted horror cursed to wander Midgard with but a single thought, propelling its husk of a body to continue to drag its feet across the Norse wilds. But, like many before him, this Draugr was not born to the violence and anger that it now spread to anyone it encountered. This Draugr once had a life, and a family, and a name. Now, only rage remained. Before the change, the monster had been a man, and he spent his life like most men of his time, fighting for food, refuge, and survival in the Norse wilds. With a small band of others who had been thrust together by necessity, they managed a life. The man attributed it to one simple rule: never yield. No matter how unforgiving the dangers of the woods became, perseverance, through the will of the goddess Freya, was all they needed to make it through. They formed a community. The man had even found love inside his makeshift family and a chance to start a real family of his own. Bringing a baby into such an uncertain world was not easy by any stretch of the imagination, but their small community rallied around the child to help protect and nurture this precious new life. The challenges remained. Thieves and bandits still managed to steal what meager offerings the group had managed to assemble for themselves. Other clans challenged the group's leaders for dominance and tried to break them apart. But their unwillingness to yield to any threat got them through and kept them together. Even faced with uncertain dangers, for a while, times were good. One morning, as the sun illuminated the sky, the shrieks of Odin's ravens on their daily swoop across Midgard woke the man. He roused his loyal group and set off east, through a patch of dark wood near their latest camp. Normally, they would have taken a day's journey around the woods, as heading straight through brought the chance of even more hidden danger. But their drinking horns had already run dry, and scouts had heard the babbling of a brook in the clearing just past the tree. Their thirst would claim them before they made the days-long journey around potential harm. Entering the woods, the man and his warriors kept a sharp look, but the trees were quiet enough that they could hear the babbling brook on the other side. As they continued deeper into the woods, the babbling grew louder. So loud, in fact, it began to seem like laughter. Low, guttural bellows, coming not from the far side of the trees, but from above? The man craned his neck toward the laughter, just as the gang of bandits swiftly descended from their branches. In an instant, they were upon the small group. He had led his clan directly into their trap. The man drew his sword as he faced the largest bandit and growled, "You will not break us." But the bandit was larger, swifter, and more desperate than the man himself. He matched each blow, and the two fought to a standstill. "I will not yield. I will not cease. You cannot win." The man spat through the blood pooling in his mouth. the bandit let out that same slow, low, guttural laugh. But I already have. Look. With a gesture, the bandit king motioned for the man to turn. He had been so focused on besting the bandit king that he hadn't seen the dozens more bandits crawling from their hiding places in the trees. They had slain his warriors and captured his women and children. As the pounding heartbeat of the battle softened in his ears, he heard the cries of his wife and child as they struggled against the chains of the bandit horde. All seemed lost, but the man's resolve had seen him through worse. As the pure rage welled inside him like a fortress fire, he turned to deliver the final blow and bellowed, "Never ye," but he never got the chance. The odds, at last, were too great. The blade from the bandit king pierced his heart before he took another step. What an odd feeling, the man thought. He felt peaceful, as if he were dreamily slumbering by a warm fire. But wait, something felt off. He was doing something important. Had he been interrupted? Hazy questions swam in his mind. As the Valkyrie approached, he had died a warrior's death, and as such, he was entitled to a warrior's reward. An eternity of battle and feasting in the great halls of Valhalla, in the presence of the All-Father Odin himself, the Valkyries were sent to warriors on their final breath to deliver such rewards and escort the fallen. As the Valkyrie drew closer, the man felt her pull, and he began to yield his claim to the realm of mortal men. As he did, he studied his new companion. Her long, perfectly braided hair, her ornate shield, and shining blade. Wait. A blade. The man remembered. The blade of the bandit king was about to pierce his heart. This must be a trick. Some spell of confusion meant to distract him from the battle. He could not be at the foot of his final reward. He could not leave his wife and child on the earthen plain. He could not. He would not yield to the specter. Never yield. He shouted with such ferocity, the Valkyrie actually shifted her balance. As the man forced his heavy body to stand, the Valkyrie remorsefully drew her sword. He lunged at her then, with all the strength and anger that he never had the chance to deliver to the bandit king, and the two locked in combat. The Valkyrie saw that she had no choice but to best this confused, fallen warrior. The man saw only the bandit king. As their swords clashed, their fight grew, hotter and hotter with the power of the Valkyrie and the burning rage of the fallen man. So hot did the conflict become that a ball of pure white flame began to form around the two. The Valkyrie remained unaffected, but the man was just a mortal man. The fire surrounded him, melting the dirt at his feet, causing him to sink into the very earth. The flame stripped away his skin, infused armor to flesh and bone. Blow by blow, the fire burned away the man he was. Gone was his life, his happy days, his wife, his child. Gone now was the man who would never yield. In his place stood a creature of pure warrior's rage, a blight on the realm of men, whose thirst for vengeance would never cease. Where the man once stood, now only a monster of rage, a Draugr, remained. The third lost page has been revealed. Witness the origin of the Draugr and other creatures that roam the realms of God of War by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Keep listening now as we delve into how these creatures sprang to life from the minds of the talented Santa Monica Studio creators Rafael Grossetti, principal character artist, and Bruno Velasquez, principal animator.
If you guys just want to introduce yourselves and talk about your role here on God of War.
My name is Rafael Grossetti. I'm principal character artist in the studio. So kind of handling all the character-related stuff in the game together with Bruno.
Hello, and my name is Bruno Velasquez. I'm the animation director here at Sony Santa Monica. I'm basically in charge of overseeing anything that moves in the game, whether it's in cinematic narrative storytelling moments or combat, bosses, AI, Kratos, anything that moves pretty much. I am lucky enough to work with an awesome team of animators that have really done great stuff. So I'm happy to be here today.
Cool. Well, first off, this is a brand new world with entirely new types of creatures and enemies. How do the dangers of Norse myth compare to the dangers of Greek myth?
Well, I would say it's very interesting because I guess, you know, other than just the inspiration, right? Like the sources are different, right? The Greek myth, there's so many great, cool creatures like the Minotaur, the Medusa, centaurs that are very varied and distinct in the Norse mythology. So I think for us, it was just exciting to kind of move away from the Greek period because now we had all these new pantheon, all these different creatures that we could tap that we weren't able to explore before, like trolls and ogres. You know, the draugrs, there's so many, you know, dragons, you know, you wouldn't expect to see dragons in Greek mythology. So all of a sudden it was just like a clean slate. It was very exciting to be able to tap into this whole new pantheon. So.
Yeah. Also the, I think the past games almost felt like Kratos was fighting through armies and armies and trying to get, everybody was like against him. But in this new universe, almost feels like you just stepping into this world and there's, the creatures are just living there. Mm-hmm. And as you go through your, objective, you know, you just kind of encounter them and they're not per se against you, but just they're just in your way, you know, to when you want to do things instead of just always trying to fight an army in a kind of like waves of characters.
So yeah, we've
living in the universe.
Yeah, for sure. That's something that we've been trying to push in this game. Before you would see the enemies kind of like spawn out of, you know, just teleport in or come or crawl out of the ground from a mystical portal or something. So we're trying to put some a lot more effort on sort of having the creatures and monsters kind of live in the world and you sort of come across them. You know, you're walking through their territory and they're just doing their own thing, living their own lives. You know, kind of like in the E3 2006 reveal, we had the troll under the bridge, which is another Norse myth, right? And he just kind of pops out because he's just kind of hungry and you happen to come across his bridge and he doesn't like anybody to do that. So yeah, we're trying to do more of that in this time around.
So how many of the characters come from or are inspired from Norse mythology and how many are original creations for the game?
Pretty much all the characters come from some kind of a myth. Like we do a lot of just adaptation from the myths and trying to come up with our own take and change a little bit the story of the character, but all of them have some kind of inspiration. If it's like a creature with you know, a body of a tiger and a tail of some other creature that comes from a certain myth, we'll do a little bit of our own interpretation and trying to bring that God of War signature to the design of the character, but the original idea always, I think pretty much every creature comes from a certain myth, and we have a design team that is always looking for that kind of stuff and coming up with cool characters based on even a small description that was found in like a book or something. There's always can start a spark for some creature that sometimes there's not a lot of description about the creature, but we take just a little bit and just, you know, go on and on about it.
Yeah, like in mythology, there is, sometimes isn't a lot of backstory, and things like trolls have very wildly. What sort of other sources of inspiration did you bring in when designing the characters?
Yeah, so I think the history of the studio has always been to take mythology and then add our own twist to it. So I think what we try to do is we try to come up with a story behind each monster, each creature, you know, where they came from, maybe what, who are they aligned with, you know, who are they loyal to, you know, what's sort of a little bit of a background for each one. So for example, the troll, we didn't want to just make just a troll with a club and a tree club and he just smashes thing. Like, I think a difference in our troll is he has that sort of magical totem, right? So there's a little bit something more to him. Also the fact that he can speak the ancient Norse language, you know, rather than just being a brute, mindless brute, you know, it's kind of gives little hints that there's more to him. So we always try to add a little twist to each character and try to find ways to make them interpret them in the way that they were demonstrated in the Norse myth, but also add a little twist on it, a little spin on it, just to differentiate them from other interpretations.
Yeah. Like, how does that affect their design and animation?
Oh, it affects a lot. Like, given the stuff that Bruno was mentioning, of giving his own totem, like, that for us kind of sparked a lot of different designs. Like, how does he interact with that? Like, how does, you know, what is his religion? Like, how does he, even how, you know, how does he walk? How does he fight? Like, what happens when he loses it? Like, what's the, if the source is coming from that, like, what, how does that affect his skin and how, you know, kind of the reaction of him using that for a long period of time. So even on his back, you can see it's all changed because he's carrying that magic source. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the stuff, it makes it easier for us because then we can just go on and make, like, you know, almost imagine everything that's happening with that character based on just a simple twist. So it just definitely makes it a lot easier just designing a troll that we've seen before.
Yeah. Even the totem itself, when we first figured out that was going to be the kind of weapon that he was going to use in animation, we were thinking, well, how could we have him wield it a little differently than just some big rock or a tree trunk, right? So what we decided is to add ropes that were strategically, like, tied around the totem. So then that way the troll can, like, grip it in different ways and swing it in different manners. And that was sort of distinguish it, you know, from just being a big giant pillar, right? And also the way that, and then also kind of give you a little backstory that him just taking the time to wrap up these those ropes around it, it's like there's more thought behind it, right? Other than just
That also started a different conversation because then we started placing, and you might encounter a lot of these totems in the game, but not with the trolls. Like before, they would take them and use them as their weapon. And then we start putting a lot of, as if people would come and also pray to those totems. And there's like a lot of, we're trying to develop this whole religion around this certain object. So I think one idea kind of sparks another one and just kind of people just build upon that.
Yeah.
And that's how the unique stuff kind of gets built.
Yeah. And any way you can tie it back to the environment, I think that's a big win, right? So that way it's not just a character that's randomly placed in the room and you just walk in and you fight them. Like, you know, what is the reason why this guy's even in there, right? Yeah, that was something that perhaps we didn't answer very well in the previous games, but now we're trying to answer that a little better.
As players travel to the different realms and different places, they'll encounter different sets of creatures. How do the environments these creatures live in help inform what they look like, and act like, and fight like?
That's a funny thing because as an artist, we always look for those type of things and make it feel cohesive. But because the game is big and any encounter can happen anywhere, it's hard for us to make a character feel that he belongs to that environment. With that said, we go a long ways to try to make sense of what they belong to, where they are. And we have a bunch of systems that allows us to, if they're living in a snow environment, that we put snow on them, or if they're coming from like a mud pit, that we have snow mud building up on them, and that helps make them feel like they've been there for quite some time. We also have, you know, different realms, so different creatures, we have that ability to make them feel realm specific. But even that, like, those creatures can appear on different realms. So it's kind of like, as an artist, we try to get it into to feel cohesive, but with the game, with the scope of the game and how big the thing everything is, and creatures can travel between realms, it's hard to, you know, sometimes it might feel out of place, but you know, there's a reason for that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always a challenge because, let's say, combat determines that the wolf is their quick character, right? Like the fast character, and gives you a type of feedback in the combat for the player, right? Type of experience. Well, they might want to place that wolf in a certain situation that maybe the environment doesn't fit. So it's always a balance of, like, how are we going to place these enemies that makes it feel cohesive, but also take into account the gameplay, right? The feedback and the combat loop, right? You're going to need to place certain types of enemies in certain places to make a fight harder or more fun, or, you know, give you a different type of mood, right? So it's always that challenge to balance the character placement in the environment.
Going back to the process of creating these creatures, when you begin the concept art process for different characters, what pieces do you look to for inspiration for the characters in the world?
Well, there's a lot of just environment, like you said. Usually when you get, like, even different realms or a design idea for a creature, it comes with, like, inspirations from the things that they like. So it could be like a different game or real references. And then we just kind of, on the concept side, we just kind of go wide, and then we start funneling. Once we start, Corey likes or something, or design or different directors kind of like some ideas. Usually those wide ideas is more of a, it's challenging because we have to bring it down to what the game is, like that more what the fit on the Norse universe. And for us to be able to do that, usually we start bringing more of the historical references. So for example, we have a creature that the initial idea was like, oh, this, it's an alien. It's more of an insect alien, but how do you make like an insect alien feel Norse and still feels like it belongs in the God of War universe? And what we do, we kind of go wide once we like something and to make it not feel sci-fi, because it's very easy to kind of go wide and just make it feel more sci-fi because of a design idea. We start bringing back more historical references and kind of working on the costume and making it feel like it belongs to our universe. And usually, runes and just more Norse references make it feel, make the costume feel like it belongs. And that's usually the process for all the characters. We kind of go wide and then we start bringing more real references and more historical references and make them feel more like they belong to that period.
Yeah, it's a bit of a catch-22, right? Because working in mythology, you have it's almost cheating a little bit because you have this rich history of all these characters that are already, mm-hmm. there's tons of stories about them. So how do you take that and then make it your own, right? Add your own twist to it so that it doesn't feel like it's just something you've seen, many times before. How do you add enough of a twist to make it unique for our game? Yeah, it's always a challenge, but I think Raf and his team, they've been able to really knock it out of the park when it comes to that.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about the motion capture and stuff like that, but back to the concept art, how does the character design change over the course of the concept art phase?
It changes a lot, even not for the character, but even talking just about the game in general. Like when we started this, it was a different direction and us trying to find where the style fits, because there's a lot of Norse games out there and even Norse movies, but we're trying to find our like pre-Viking period and how we can develop our own style based on that. Even like for Kratos, for example, we started just exploring very different types of costumes for him and like going very rough out. So like not so much, because that was his initial idea. It was like everything is like very rough and very simple, very minimalism. So Kratos, like if initial designs, if you look at him, it's like very simple costume, just, almost like no costume at all. Just kind of like a fur pelt and that's it. And once we start developing more and looking at more references and what can we do to bring it back that feel of like almost like heroic feel to the design, we start adding more of the little fabric details and more of the patterns to make it feel more, period. So it's stuff like that evolved. And then once we had a style kind of developed and stuff that we liked, that kind of translated to all the other characters. So talking like a character, usually when it starts with like all the silhouettes, there's certain expectation of what the character should look like. When we start kind of putting in the game and kind of animators playing with it and making, see how it feels and how it behaves, then we can start pulling more different references and working on the costume and see what works and having that balance between how much detail we put on those characters. Some characters, more narrative characters, need a lot more detail and more attention to those narrative, specific details to kind of tell a story. So there's a lot of that, we kind of work together and collaborate a lot of like, how does he move? What does he, what type of costume is he going to have? And that changes. It's not like someone is drawing something and someone just make that. It's a lot of collaboration back and forth and looking at the needs and all that stuff.
Yeah, one of the coolest moments in the project was when the concept art team released the lineup of the entire cast. So they just put it all in one image, right? And it's still my desktop up to this day, because basically this is the time where you got to see all the work that each individual artist put into each one of these characters, but all together, see how they relate to each other, what their silhouettes are, what weapons they wield, what costumes they wear. And I think like that is the key, like Rav was saying, like how they connect to each other and how they complement each other and what roles they serve in the game. That's always a challenge, right? Because you could focus so much on one guy and add so much detail to it, but then how is that going to work together with the other characters, right? Yeah. So that was a really cool moment when we saw that lineup.
We started since the beginning of the project because mm-hmm. we had all the lineup, all the character, the cast defined. So we did a very, just mm-hmm. a very silhouetted lineup from the beginning, just so when we start working on those characters, we can see that they're completely different from each other. Different classes have, you know, different silhouette from the start, even without any details or any specific costume or anything. And then as we move, you know, forward within the project, we were just updating that until that day when we had all the casts updated, so we can look at, you know, and it was pretty cool. Yeah.
And that kind of stuff usually gets the team so excited, right? When they see it, they're like, okay, when can we animate this? When will we start modeling this, right? So it was a really cool moment.
What's the next step after silhouettes?
So after silhouettes, we start just blocking it out in the game. So we do a couple, we call gray meshes. So it's a very simple mesh that we send it to the tech team, and they put a rig on it so they can move the characters. And then that goes to animation so they can start playing with poses in the game and trying to replicate some of the feel that we had on the quick sketches into the game. And then usually after that, we have a scale review. So then we get the directors and look at the enemy into the game so we can kind of pick his scale, something that feels good when Kratos is fighting it. Because usually when we lock the scale and the animators go wide on it, it's very hard for us to change, you know, the scale of the character. So after that's locked.
That scale review, man, it's such a interesting meeting because you have, you know, you have all the artists, you have everybody there staring at, well, so what we do is we have the animators post out the character in like 30 to 40 different poses. So they're like, this whole, you load up this level where Kratos can run around this essentially museum of poses, right? For this character. So it's like in all the statue-like poses, but very dynamic poses. We think about like the base pose, like the idle pose, the running pose, the jumping pose, everything that the character is going to do is sort of represented. But that day is pretty tough because you have a lot of eyes on this and we're tweaking the scale, you know, like real time. We'll like, okay, add, you know, 0.2 and 0.5. And there's all these debates, like combat is there, Raph is there. All the representatives from all the departments are there, and there's always this like uneasy debate of like, oh man, I want it to be this big and I want it to be that big.
Usually art in animation is like bigger, but then the design is usually, no, smaller, because, you know, if you make it big, it's hard. It's even harder for us to make it work. This is God of War, so we want big, you know, big characters. Right. And so we ended up a lot of rough decisions. Like some characters are huge and it's, you know, it's still tough to this day to make it feel nice. So it's fun.
He walks through the challenges of adapting 2D concept art to 3D models.
There's a lot of challenges. I think the biggest one is more like working in the game with this quality and just trying to push the quality. There's always the balance between how much detail you put into certain designs. Because we have no camera cut in this game, all the characters need to work for gameplay purposes and cinematics at the same time. So there's no changing assets or anything like that. So the detail that you have to see on the cinematic and the, you know, super high fidelity, when you put it on the gameplay side and you're looking at the character for a distance, you also have to worry about just overall read of the character. If it reads good from far, if you know what you're looking for, like Bruno's saying, like putting a missive in certain areas and make it feel like you know where the attacks are coming from. So there's this big balance between when you translate a 2D design to the game, like how do we usually change a lot of things and how do we balance those out? Because you only know when you're playing the game. So there's a lot of, you do a first pass and you get it in from the concept. But once you start playing the game, there's a lot of just back and forth and changing things on the fly and going back and looking at, you know, cinematics. Usually you look at a cinematic halfway through the game and the character doesn't look good there. So you start making changes because of that cinematic, and then that affects, you know, the game in overall. So there's a lot of just playing the game, changing stuff. Or the concept team here is amazing. So the concepts are very, very, very good. So we have a lot to work from. Pipeline wise, we just use a lot of ZBrush and Photoshop, and use ZBrush to do the high fidelity sculpts. And then we translate that into using Maya to the game and do our textures in Photoshop and all that. But yeah, there's just a lot of challenges when you get into the game and how gameplay and cinematics and lighting and all that plays together.
Yeah, for sure. Like I think in the 2D process in that stage, the artist has a clean slate, right? A white piece of paper, a white screen, you know, to just put whatever they want on there. We try not to restrict them, you know, just come up with the coolest, craziest stuff that you can think of. But then as we start getting closer to, okay, now we got to put this in the game, we got to model it, we got to animate it. You know, if someone presents us a quadruped with 9 tails and 3 heads and some bat wings, right? looks awesome on paper, right? But wait, how are you going to animate this? How are we going to make this move? You know, so we got to think about those things. So sometimes the designs evolve and change based on the challenges that we face getting them to actually work in game. So they might only have one head or I'm sorry, two heads instead of three, and maybe just make it like three tails instead of nine, right? So we still retain some of the original ideas, but maybe just kind of pare them down so that it will actually work.
Can you sort of walk us through the process of animating a character? Like, what are the various steps? Or do you use motion capture? Is it all hand, or do you hand animate? Or
yeah, so we had a bit of a big overhaul of our animation system for this new project. So the previous games, it was roughly 90% keyframe animation, 10% motion capture, and the motion capture was mostly used on the cinematics, the narrative moments. But this time around, we kind of flipped that over. Now it's about 80% motion capture and 20% keyframe. So it was a bit of a challenge to have that shift, right? We had to go through a lot of, kind of getting the animators used to switching the way they approach things, right? And I think it was important to get them involved in the motion capture process themselves from the very beginning. So the animators were jumping on suits. We were like starting to, act out things and making the characters move ourselves. Cool. And I think that helped a lot for that transition. So now what we do is we look for actors that are capable of delivering the, like actors like Chris Judge, who's been playing Kratos, right? So now we are basically going this route unlocks the opportunity to have a full body performance with dialogue and the face all captured at the same time. So that has really unlocked the potential of having a lot more subtle movement, a lot more detailed movement. And as far as the creatures, we have a lot of talented stunt performers and stunt actors and actresses that have come in. And, we're fortunate enough to have a mocap studio right next to our studio that's run by Sony. And we've been able to hire a lot of talented people and work with them to kind of get us as close as possible to what the characters are going to end up moving and feeling like in the game. And then, of course, you need a crew of talented animators and character tech artists that create the rigs to get us to the point where we can get those performances from the motion capture and then we would go in there and enhance them and improve them and tweak them. But yeah, I mean, speaking of the PS4, I mean the facial animation that we're able to achieve now, it's a lot higher fidelity than we were able to do before. So yeah, it's been challenging to switch from keyframe to motion capture, but I think it's paying off in the end. Because I mean, these guys are giving us really detailed characters now, So now we gotta keep up with them, right? So make sure that the motion feels natural.
Yeah. How'd you guys determine how, like, for example, a Draeger walks? Were you guys just staggering around here like zombies? Or?
So I think the determination of how a character moves always comes from finding out what the background is on that character, right? So we would sit down with the narrative, with the writers, and then see, okay, what is the history of this character? Where does he come from? How do they fit in Norse mythology? So the Draugr, essentially, he's kind of like a warrior that died but was not able to go to Valhalla. So he's sort of reanimated in Midgard, and it's cool because part of the concept has his armor sort of fused into his body, and this is. So the idea behind him is that he's sort of this undead warrior that has no self-preservation. He's just sees an enemy, sees an opponent, and he's just going to go and attack and fight. So that sort of dictates, okay, the way he moves is that he's never going to sort of try to evade you or back up away from you. He's always going to charge. So that sort of information then dictates, okay, so the type of movement is going to be like this relentless sort of Terminator type of character that is just, but then again, because he's undead, he doesn't have the full use of his body like that he did when he was alive. So then he's coming at you as best as he can. So he's like shambling along and trying to attack Kratos as soon as he sees him.
All right, so I have one last question. Do you have a favorite creature in the game and why?
Well, I don't know if I could talk about him yet. But
I have one that just feels special, and that's more the world snake. to me, it was something that from the beginning we knew we were going to do that. And because of the story, like the Norse mythology, there's such a big character and such a big character in the game as well. Like not big, narrative big, but, you know, in the game it's huge. And it's also pushing the, you know, the technology for us to be able to do that. Because, you know, with the game, you interact with the creature in a lot of different ways. You get very close and you get very far, and how you fit that into the environment that she's living in. And design-wise, it's like, how do you make a snake talk? It was also a big challenge. How do you make a snake look like a different creature was also a big challenge. We also run into a lot of discussions of the Hydra from the past games. You know, there was a lot of inspiration pulled from that, but just because of, you know, God of War, but how do we make that feel different? Because it's also like a snake type of creature that we did before. So it's kind of like, it was a good challenge. I think for me, it's the favorite just because of, I've been working on it for many, many years. And I think the way it turned out on the trailer was fantastic. So
looked really cool. For fans unfamiliar with Norse mythology, what can you tell us about the Midgard Serpent?
The basics is, you know, it's a creature that, you know, travels around Midgard and wraps around the world and bites its own tail. And also, you know, again, for us in the game, we kind of take a little bit of that and kind of put our own take on it. So the kind of stuff that we can't really discuss now, but I can't wait to see you show a little bit of what we've been doing with the creature.
I thought about a character I can't talk about, actually. So recently, part of our trailer at E3, we revealed some new characters, not necessarily an enemy or a monster or anything like that, but they're one of them is Sindri and Brock. Essentially, there's these dwarven characters in the game. They're kind of going to serve as the shopkeepers that you interact with. But they're definitely my favorite. I can't really get into details, but they bring this kind of comedic factor into this otherwise very serious game. And I think it's cool to see Kratos interact with someone without having to kill them. And it's definitely something new, you know, the way that Kratos and the Sun connect with them. It's pretty cool. I hope the fans enjoy that. But definitely, those are my favorite characters.
Well, yeah, there are so many great creatures from Norse mythology, and I'm really excited to see what your guys' interpretations of them are. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk to us. Mm-hmm.